So, I mean, I guess first I just wanted to give a really brief, like super brief intro to like DC, the DC Trans Coalition, and a really short history of like what the campaign that we've just are in the middle of looks like, and then we can just basically open up for like a sort of discussion or a question and answer, hopefully more of a discussion, but. Basically the DC Trans Coalition formed in like 2005, I believe, and it was sort of a initiative or a group effort of like a whole bunch of other groups, and I think there's like 11 or 12 groups that are technically part of the DC Trans Coalition or like the sort of founding members of it, such as like Transgender Health Empowerment, La Clínica del Pueblo, and there's a whole, I can't remember all the groups that are
And
part.
like HIPS is part of
Yeah,
it,
what HIPS is the sex workers support group.
different avenues was around that
Yeah,
time, right? The different
Different Avenues is
avenues.
like a youth center for like mostly homeless LGBTQ youth.
Right, and then was Women Walker associated with
I
it?
think Women Walker, which is the clinic,
Yeah.
the LGBT mostly HIV clinic, like well, they were founded as like a to combat HIV. So I mean, there's a whole bunch of other groups too. I know Latinas en Acción is part of it, and. So there's a whole bunch of groups that came together around trying to get gender identity and expression added to the human rights law. And DC has like one of the most progressive like human rights laws in the country, in the US. So they were trying to get that added, and they did. And that went through in 2006. So that was added to that. And since that time, DCTC has focused on the enforcement of those regulations mostly. So trying to like actually make sure that what's on paper is put into practice. So they've kind of systematically targeted different district agencies. So they started with the fire and EMS, the fire department and the emergency medical services, because there was specifically this case of a woman named Tyra Hunter, who was a trans woman who basically was bleeding to death, and then the ambulance came to pick her up, and they laughed at her, and she died. They literally were too busy laughing at her and did not help her at all, so she died. So that's where they started, was focusing on the fire and EMS. And then they did other things like the Department of Motor Vehicles, so that they could make sure that people could change their ID documents. And so like just one after one, just sort of like we're knocking down agencies left and right. And then about a year and a half or a couple of years ago, they held a big community forum, so just like a giant gathering of people from the community, and we're like, well, what's the priorities of the community? Like, where should we focus? Like, what's the next step? And so, sort of after that, and like ongoing consultation with the community, they decided that the police department and the jail were the two things that really need to be dealt with. So they first worked with did a campaign against the police department. And successfully got them pretty quickly, actually, got them to issue. And they also have a really horrible reputation dealing with trans people in the city, especially low-income trans women of color. And just for some other background, like DC has this law that came out around the same time called the Prostitution Free Zones, which basically just allows them to declare a certain block or a certain radius a prostitution free zone and then just like arrest anyone that they profile as a sex worker within that area, and it's like, they just sort of master it. So basically, what they do is there's like the one corner, right, where all the trans women who work the streets hang out, and they just like, arrest all of the mess. And then HIPS, who was the sex worker outreach group in DC, like did a report that said that 40%, I believe, of all sex work related crimes in DC were of trans women. So yeah, big problems, and of course, the way they're treated is terrible. But they got the police department to issue a general order on the handling of trans people, which basically said that, like be respectful, use proper name and pronouns, and strip searches must be done by officers of the chosen gender, and so like pretty like they met pretty much the demands that were formed at the community forum pretty well. So then after that, focused on the jail. So we had like the list of demands that were created at this community forum, and then, but the jail was like definitely the hardest of all of the things that we like. I wasn't there for most of the other stuff, but from what I understand, was like definitely it took like a year and a half, and I was at some of the initial meetings with the Department of Corrections, which even just getting meetings with them was like really hard. But they literally laughed at us, fell asleep in the meetings with us, and then just like were totally just like completely condescending, like completely, you know, they didn't take it seriously at all. So it took about a year and a half, and you know, trying different tactics. We had a protest, like a picket line in front of the Department of Corrections. You know, did a lot of things, and then in the middle of it, this is sort of a convoluted story. I'm going to try and make it really quick, but the Attorney General of the District of Columbia was basically worked with the Department of Corrections to try and add a clarification, that's what they called it, to the human rights law that would have clarified it by exempting all incarcerative any district agency that held people in custody. So that would have included the Department of Corrections, homeless shelters, youth shelters, like anything like that where the government houses people. So it would have completely exempted them from obeying the human rights law entirely. And they also try to do other things. There's some of the protections in the human rights law specifically state in the regulations of it, of how the enforcement regulations, that trans people have access to whichever bathroom that they want, and that all single stall bathrooms in the district are required to be gender neutral. But that's not actually the case in reality, but it's on the books, is what it says. So they tried to take that away also. They tried to do a bunch of stuff that was really sketchy. But it kind of blew up in their faces because we were able to basically successfully mobilize this like way broader campaign around that than we could get around the jail. Because I mean, the sad truth is that a lot of people didn't really care about the jail, and we're just like, well, why are we focusing so much time and energy into the jail? Like, it's, you know, whatever. Because especially like, you know, relatively privileged people who aren't going to go to jail don't really care about it. So. But then all of a sudden they tried to take away the human rights law stuff, and people were up in arms and furious about it. And then also because it would have like affected way more than just the trans community, because you know, if you talk about making an exemption for all custodial agencies from the Human Rights Act, you know, this can apply to like I don't know, like a lot of like disability rights activists, you know, were really concerned about it. So basically, like, we were able to successfully mobilize people around that issue and got, like, 200 or 300 petition signatures, like, a dozen or more, like, letters written to the district government from all sorts of organizations, like, ranging from the American Civil Liberties Union, even, like, the Human Rights Campaign, which is the huge, like, notoriously, like, transphobic LGBT. Or, like, we had, like, all these national, like, the Lawyers Guild wrote us letters. So we had like this huge thing culminating in, there was a hearing about Peter Nichols where the city council was either going to confirm him or deny him, or like basically fire him, sort of. So we presented all this testimony with some of our allied organizations on why they should fire him. But they didn't fire him. What they did instead was basically say, we're only going to confirm you if you deal with this, if you give them basically what they want. So they did. They confirmed him. He, you know, he kept his job. And then we basically forced him to force the Department of Corrections to actually meet with us and take us seriously. And then at this point, we had this, you know, the attention on this issue was huge all of a sudden. Like, all of the local, like, GLBT papers were covering it. Like, all the city council people knew about it. We'd had one-on-one meetings with the city council people about it. Like, attention was just on this. Like, you know, there's a lot of, like, pressure. So, and we also had lawyers by this point. We had, like, lawyers working with us. So then we went back and, you know, said, like, here's our original demands. You know, this is what we want. And they came out with a policy that's not exactly what we want, but it's it's groundbreaking in that the bar is so low that it's like a step above, but it's, you know, they're very proud of it and they like to talk about it as the most progressive policy. And the truth is that it is probably one of the most progressive policies in the world. But that's not really saying much whenever things are really, really terrible. you know, I wasn't going to go into so much detail about why prisons and jails are so terrible for trans people, but, you know, just a couple of quick things, like rates of sexual assault for women in the men's unit are like 70-80% compared to, I think, 3 or 4% for, this is reported, of course, for men who are there. And then, of course, just denial of any medical attention, denial of services. Like, there's a, you know, I could go on and on about all the problems. So yeah, we got this policy, and so just to sort of summarize it, it has some things in about strip searches. They must be done in private and not in front of people, because they were sort of notorious for strip searching like women in front of large groups of men, basically for entertainment. So they can't do that, and they're not supposed to do that. And then they will have access to hormones if they're on it. And if they have not, if they're not prescribed to hormones, then they can start hormones while they're incarcerated. And this would be one of the first, like one of the very few jurisdictions in the world that where people could actually start hormones if they weren't previously on it. That's something we've, you know, we're really excited about and fought hard for that. Especially because a lot of the women who go in there are on hormones, but not, don't necessarily have prescriptions for it, because it's really hard to access, you know, like legal medical services, especially for like low-income trans women of color who are sex workers and live on the street. So a lot of them have, like, you know, get it on the black or gray market. So it was really important that, rather, if they get arrested, normally they just be cut off and like go through withdrawal, and just, you know, it's terrible. So we were really excited about that. And then in general, there's also some stuff in the policy about keeping people safe and not discriminating in their access to services and things like that. And then the biggest thing is the housing policy, which was the most contentious issue as well. And so from our original demands that we formulated with the community, we never wanted a blanket housing policy that would have said all trans people go here, you know, like, because we realized that it's really complicated, because like a lot of trans men probably would prefer and be safer in the women's unit than in the men's unit. And likewise, there's a lot of like trans women who really like don't want to be put in the women's unit, you know. So we didn't want any sort of like, you know, overarching blanket policy that would have determined where everybody went. We instead wanted something that respected everyone's individual needs and like took in their own opinion about where they would be safest. So what that sort of looks like, and what they've done with that, is they've created a special committee called the Transgender Housing Committee. And it's the same as all of the housing, like every person at intake when they get arrested goes through a housing placement process where there's a committee with like a mental health professional, a social worker, the staff from DOC are on this committee, and they decide where to house the, like what ward to put them in, and whether or not they will be put into protective custody. And protective custody is basically what's popularly thought of as solitary confinement. It's, you know, you're in 23-hour lockdown a day, basically. And before, their sort of solution to the sorts of violence and sexual assault that trans women, especially trans women, faced in the men's jail, was to put them into the PC. And a lot of, you know, some of them preferred being in PC over being in general population, because you know, things are so terrible in general population that they'd rather just be in 23-hour lockdown. So that was kind of their solution. They would keep, like, I think the federally mandated standards is you're not supposed to keep anyone in PC for more than, like, a set amount of time. That's like a few days or weeks sometimes. But they would keep them there for, like, their entire sentence, which was, like, 6 or 8 months. So we had like, that's not a good enough solution. So the housing committee they created is the same, the trans housing committee is the same as the regular housing committee, except they added an advocate from the trans community, who we will have some say in who that's going to be. We already know who it's going to be for now. And that person's role would basically be to advocate, you know, for the person. And it's someone that we know and trust really well, and has been working and like goes into the jail like once a week to like deliver support and stuff. And she's been doing this for a long, long time. So we're really excited that because she's really awesome. So she's going to be on this committee, and basically they'll interview the prison, like the inmates. So I have to say we're not allowed to say prisoners, but they'll interview the person about where they feel safest. They also take into consideration their record, like what their past convictions are, and all sorts of things, and then decide whether to put them into general population male, protective custody male, or general population female, or protective custody female. So basically, this is like one of, I think, only three or four policies that I've seen in the entire world where a trans person could actually even have the possibility of being placed in gender identity. So we did a lot of research, and I've seen basically every policy like in the world. And there's some jurisdictions in New Zealand and Spain and some random places that do that, but not very many. So I mean, it's really exciting. But I also just wanted to talk briefly about some of what we didn't get, since some of the things that we're still kind of fighting for. So the housing policy is great, but there are still flaws in it, in that it's putting a lot of arbitrary power into this committee, and it's great that we have someone on board that we trust, but it's still like we feel like we want to make sure that this committee can be held accountable and we know what they're going to do. So we feel like it needs to be transparent, but also transparent in a way that protects the privacy of the person, because, you know, obviously we don't want like their records released publicly or anything like that. But so that's kind of complicated. And they also said the policy, when it lists the sorts of things that they will take into consideration when making housing placement decisions, still includes genitalia. And we've been assured that's like, we will consider this, but it won't be the determining factor, so that like a pre or non-op trans woman could still be put into the women's general population. But we just don't really trust them to do that, because they're obviously like, in my conversations with them, are very prejudiced and just don't understand the reality of like that situation or people's bodies at all. So we're still pretty upset about that, and we feel like that's still kind of a problem. They also wouldn't fold on pronoun usage. Their sort of compromise was to declare that all inmates will be referred to with gender neutral markers, such as like inmate number, blah, 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 or inmate last name, whatever. But this is like, I personally, and I think we all feel sort of like that's just this giant loophole, because like I find it kind of infeasible and ridiculous that they would expect that like guards would never ever use anyone's pronouns ever. So we feel like that they have an obligation to declare that, you know, anyone who uses improper pronouns needs some sort of like, you know, reprimandation or reprimand or something. So, but they wouldn't fold on that. And again, sort of took this like what looks like a compromise, but is actually sort of a loophole. And then also clothing was a huge problem, because they still will only issue clothing that's gender segregated, so that if a trans woman were placed into the men's unit, either because she wanted to be there or was placed there, she would still be issued men's clothing and have to, abide by the same sort of personal appearance rules and regulations, which means they'll cut her hair and stuff like that. Because that's one of the things that all the girls I've talked to who've been there, like that's the first thing they do, is just like cut your hair off. So that these sorts of practices are like devastating to people's, you know, like mental health, and it's just, you know, it's barbaric really. And so they're still going to be doing that, with some exceptions, because we did get them to like say that they will issue trans women bras when medically indicated, which is also just like ridiculous. So like if one of the doctors like says that you need a bra, then you get one. But this is the kind of ridiculous stuff that they just like will just like put up fights about. And the thing is like that is still in direct like a direct violation, direct contradiction of the human rights law, which specifically states that people have, you know, the human right or whatever to express their gender identity regardless of anything. So, you know, regardless of where someone's placed, if a trans woman is put in the men's unit, she still has the fundamental right, according to DC law, to express her gender identity. So that's still a direct violation, and we're still kind of fighting about it. I mean, so those are the biggest things. There's some other, like, you know, smaller things in the policy that went on, but those are the biggest things. So where we're at right now is sort of, we have been in communication with our city council people who are all pretty unanimously supportive of us. DC is sort of a weird anomaly in the US where the district is actually very small, and it's like majority people of color, mostly like Black and Latina, and fairly progressive in terms of, like, there's like one Republican on our whole city council, like the conservative, and not even really like a Republican. And so it's really strange in some ways, and kind of unique situation, because also the district is not technically a city, it's also not a state, it's a federal district, so it's complicated, but it's sort of like, it's exciting because we have a very small city council, and so we know all of them, and we can like go meet with them and stuff, and then what they do sort of has a larger impact than just any city would, because it's the District of Columbia, so it's like a little more, like, has a little more weight to it, I guess, because it's sort of equivalent to a state, even though it's not. So, yeah, so we're working with the city council people to try and basically get them to come out and say and do something, like issue a policy that says that the Department of Corrections is still in violation of the Human Rights Act. And there have been a couple of council people who have said they would do that. So that's kind of where we're at. And we also just had another community forum to sort of present what happened and talk about this policy. And so we're also doing a lot of outreach and, like, know your rights. So it's, like, now things have changed, and, like, they're not just going to, like, tell everyone this. Like, we sort of have taken up that responsibility, or we need to, like, disseminate this and, like, make sure everyone who might get arrested knows about it. So that's kind of what we're doing with this campaign now. And that's, like, pretty much the summary that I was going to give. So do you have anything to add on?
Not really. I mean, that's a pretty substantial overview. I mean, when I was thinking about what we could possibly talk about, I don't know how much you all are interested in terms of, like, organizing efforts, like what kinds of organizing techniques are successful. And I think DC is a really unique space in that it is progressive, but it's also really conservative when you compare it to other worldwide cities. Like, compared to, I mean, I don't know Montreal that well, but I know, like, San Francisco better, for example. I mean, DC is extraordinarily conservative. It's probably one of the most conservative big cities. It's not even that big. It's really small. It's only 10 miles across, or, like, what, 20 kilometers? Really small. But it's the way in which this was successful was not just organizing among, you know, radical people, but really was outreaching to some very conservative, you know, people down on the Hill. So it took all kinds of action that, you know, required a degree of, gentleness, I guess. I don't know what I would term it. Like Sadie and I met with the head of the Department of Corrections, and this guy is, like, literally, he's horrendous. I mean, prisoners to him are a waste of time. Their very existence, it frustrates him. He hates them. So arguing against to him, saying, okay, these are why these people deserve very basic rights, was really didn't mean much to him, because he doesn't really value their rights to begin with. So that was difficult. So that was definitely an example in which we came up against a brick wall. But because of DC's unique sort of setup as a very, very small city, where you're essentially being represented by a group of people that represent their wards, which is kind of the smaller, you know,
counties or subsets are really neighborhoods of DC, and so they're very accessible. I mean, we, I think, know where most of the council members live. I mean, they're, you know, I lived next to one of them for a while, and so I guess that's probably in terms of like the organizing that I've done in my, you know, activism. This is DC organizing is by far the most unique from my experience anyway, is that in that you're really working, like, it's not a matter of whether you want to or not, you have to. Like, if you want your campaign to be successful, you literally have to know and be willing to dress pretty, put on a suit, a dress, whatever. I mean, Sadie cleans up so well, it's incredible. pretty amazing. So I don't know. So I don't know how much you are interested in that. I mean, but I think DC is a very interesting example of the absolute necessity of working with people who, like, I would never have turned to or been interested in organizing with. So,
yeah. And then we can also, I mean, like, other things that I'm personally interested in talking about is sort of the really, like, awkward dynamics, or, like, awkward's not a strong enough word, but complicated dynamics that creates, because effectively we sort of become representatives.
Sorry.
So, you know, we sort of effectively become representatives of our community in this really problematic way. And, you know, basically that they, when we were, like, specifically working with this guy Peter Nichols, who was the Attorney General, I mentioned a little bit earlier, like, but he, once we scared him enough, because we, you know, almost took away his job, you know, literally this guy in the hearing when we were presenting against him, like, presenting our testimony or evidence against him, like, he was, like, shaking, and, like, he was, like, scared of us, which was pretty exciting for me, but he, you know, like, he, as soon as that happened, he was like, holy crap, I have to do something about this, I have to get these people off my back. So he tried to, like, push this through as fast as he could, and was like, we have to resolve this, give them what they want, and get it over with. But so then what happened was they like rammed us through so fast that we had no time to effectively, like, do outreach in our community and, like, say, like, well, because they basically presented us, like, with, here's our policy, like, what do you think about it? You have 1 week to decide. And so in 1 week, we couldn't, you know, what can we do in 1 week? So we didn't really have time. And so we came back and said, like, you know, personally, we feel good about some of this. It looks good. It's a step forward. You know, this is definitely better. But we're not going to, like, accept this. We're going to keep, you know, he didn't give us time to consult our community. So, and that's really problematic because, like, although definitely DCETC is, like, a multiracial group, and there's definitely, like, you know, a fairly, for lack of a better term, diverse, like, sort of base there, it's definitely still dominated by, like, white middle class people, and, you know, so definitely, like, creates some problems whenever we are not the ones who are most likely going to be targeted for arrest and police brutality and these sorts of things. And while definitely, like, the policy affects us because, you know, most of us are trans, and so we got arrested, of course, so we are affected by this, of course, but not in the most direct ways that a lot of other people are, who are not the ones sitting at the table negotiating with the Attorney General. So definitely just sort of, like, I agree with what Elijah said about the really weird sort of situation in D.C., and, you know, it's nice because, yeah, we can put on these suits and look pretty and then go and put pressure on these people and get what we want and have, like, tangible, like, concrete changes happen that are really exciting and great, but it also is, like, can be very divisive in our community, which, you know, I think we have a responsibility to try and counteract that and do our best to, like, make sure that everyone's voices are heard. But it is, you know, sort of, while acknowledging our own responsibility, also talking about how, like, it's really hard to do that when a system that we're, like, basically working within is set up to be racist and to be, you know, classist and all these other things. So, so I don't know, at this point, unless you have more to add, I was just going to add, like, open up for questions. Oh, and I also, actually really quick. We also did a survey. I'm just going to do some of the results from our survey. So we surveyed people who live in or around the district about their experiences in gender-segregated facilities since the Human Rights Act went into effect. And so that would be everything from public restrooms to the jail. And we had a pretty good turnout after filtering through just having the people who identify as transsexual, transgender, gender non-conforming in some way. There was 93 people, 70% of whom reported having some experiences, negative experiences in gender-segregated facilities, ranging from verbal harassment to sexual assault to denial of access and all sorts of things. And then about 10%, 9 or 10% of the people had been in some sort of public housing facility, which would mean either a homeless shelter or the jail, which this is just 10% of people who had been in the jail or homeless shelter within the last 2 years in D.C., which I didn't mention this earlier, but it's kind of complicated because D.C. doesn't have a federal prison. It has only a city jail. So anyone who's sentenced to beyond 6 or 8 months gets sent to another state for federal housing. So basically, that's the other kind of crappy thing about our organizing is that, like, it's not really, like, I mean, it's very important. We know from people who go inside a lot that there's generally about 20 or 30 trans women in the jail on any given day. So, I mean, that's a lot going in and out, but on any given day, there's usually about 20 or 30. So, I mean, it still, yeah, has a huge impact, but anyone who's sentenced for a felony or for a sentence over 8 months is not going to be covered by this. They're going to be sent to another state. So basically, that means 10% of our respondents have been locked up in one way or another within the past 2 years for 8 month or less sentences. And I also sort of broke down our findings by sort of like the different demographics of age and gender and race. And our results were definitely pretty skewed toward white folks. I think about 63% of our respondents were white, but as I said earlier, the majority of people who live in the district are people of color. So it's not that much skewed, but it's definitely skewed toward white folks, and it's also it's way heavily skewed toward young people, way more than just the race. And it also found that trans women were underrepresented in our sample. So, in all honesty, while we have like 9 or 10% had been locked up within the past 2 years in the district for sentences of less than 8 months, and that's not taking into consideration the sort of like skewed data by age, race, and everything. All right, some of the other so it's probably much higher than 9 or 10% is what I'm getting at. And some of the other things that we found out. 42% of people who attended schools in D.C. had problems, and 10% dropped out because of it, related to it. 27% who worked in D.C. had been verbally harassed at work because of gender-segregated facilities. And then I found, like, for income levels, 11% had no income at all, and then 46% made less than $20,000, which is the federal poverty guidelines. 46% of people were under the federal poverty guidelines, and that was including everyone. So I also redid that by taking out people who identified as only white. And so for trans people of color who live in the city, it's 53% of them under the federal poverty guidelines. There was something else. And I guess 10% or 9% had no insurance, and 11% were on Medicare or Medicaid, which is the federal state funded healthcare, which does not cover any sort of transition stuff. And then 60% of people who wanted some sort of further procedure for transition-related things could not afford it, or said that they couldn't access it. And finally, 38% of people who responded said they had been discriminated against based on their gender and their expression since the law went into effect, and only 35 people total said that they had been discriminated against, and only 2 of them had reported it because they said that they didn't believe it would matter to report it. So these are some of the things that we found out in our survey. This is more about this situation for trans people living in DC. So questions now.